Weddings are always interesting events. It's a life-changing moment in the lives of not just two people and not even just two families, many times multiple families. One thing that is of interest in each wedding ceremony is the wedding music. You can think of songs that you have heard down through the years, maybe instrumental songs or a cappella songs or songs with both singing and instrument that you've heard at weddings. Often there'll be some music played right up to the wedding. There'll be something played as people walk in, something during the ceremony, maybe during the lighting of a candle. And there'll be some kind of recessional music and sometimes even music back at the reception after it's over. In fact, one of the things when I meet with couples about the wedding ceremony and we're talking about what we're going to do in rehearsal, as I talk to them about, do you know what music you want? Do you have somebody to oversee your music? Do you have it in a format that that person can easily go from song to song? Do you know how long each one is and when you want it played? Because all of that is an integral part of the wedding ceremony. I was recently looking at discjockey.com in which they listed the most popular, some of the most popular wedding songs that you might hear played at a wedding. As far as prelude music, music before the wedding, you might have Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, or Water Music by Handel, Ave Maria by Schubert, Ode to Joy by Beethoven, Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. Or you may think of other songs that you've heard as processional and bridal music. What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong, or Unforgettable by Nat King Cole, or In My Life by the Beatles. As you think back of the weddings you've seen over the years, I want you to think of the songs that you've heard played. How many times you've heard Sunrise, Sunset, maybe as the mothers came walking into the auditorium. Music is important in life. Music is powerful. And so it does not surprise me that, first of all, as we're continuing this series of thinking about our awesome God, that we find a book in the Bible that is basically an ancient songbook. Because singing is so powerful, and music little not only stirs the soul, but represents the outpourings of the soul. And so it's fitting and appropriate in a book that emphasizes the power of music that we would have a wedding song. As we look at Psalm 45, and if you've got your Bibles with you this morning, I hope you'll turn there. Psalm 45 is a wedding song. There is no other song or psalm quite like it in the book of Psalms. And so what I want us to do this morning is I first of all want us to read the text and then hit some highlights of it and make some application to us as individuals in our marriages and especially application to the Lord's church. So let's look at an ancient wedding song. Psalm 45 beginning in verse 1. My heart overflows with a good theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and your majesty. And in your majesty ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp. The peoples fall under you. Your arrows are in the heart of the king's enemies. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy before your fellows. All your garments are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. Out of ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad. King's daughters are among your noble ladies. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. Listen, O daughter, give attention and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house. Then the king will desire your beauty. Because he is your lord, bow down to him. The daughter of Tyre will come with a gift, and rich among the people will seek your favor. The king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is interwoven with gold. She will be led to the king in embroidered work. The virgins, her companions, will follow her, will be brought to you. They will be led forth with gladness and rejoicing. They will enter into the king's palace. In place of your fathers will be your sons. and you shall make them princes in the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, the peoples will give you thanks forever and ever." Today, I'd like to take us just a moment to look at the wedding song that is found in the book of Psalms. I think it not only is going to speak something to us about our marriages and our relationships, but it'll speak more, as the other Psalms has about our about our God. As we look at this particular passage, I want us to look at three key areas. I want us to look at the King, the Christian, and the Christ. We're going to focus on the King and the Queen in this particular Psalm, then see what applications can be made to us in our Christian lives, and then ultimately let it point us to Jesus Christ. As we begin talking about the King, let's just hit some highlights through the passage before we make some applications. First of all, you do have a subtitle, as you do with many of the Psalms, where it kind of gives an introduction. We need to remember that these subtitles were not a part of the original text. They were added after the Psalm was written, but they are very, very ancient and represent the understanding of the early Jews as to the purpose of the Psalms that are found in the book. This particular is written either by or is included among the songs that were done by the sons of Korah. This would have been a song that would have been sung by one of the temple choirs. It makes reference to that it's for the choir director. It talks about it being according to the Shoshanim, and that is a plural form of the word which means lily. There are two other psalms which have this as part of its kind of introductory comments, and then the singular version is used in the beginning of another psalm. Most folks believe that basically what it would be saying is upon the lilies or according to the lilies, and most people believe that it is the tune that it was sung by. Now, we don't know what that tune is today, but basically it was saying, here's the tune you need to use with these words. And then it ends up by saying it is a song of love. And so right in the middle of the book of Psalms, you have a love song. You've got all these psalms dealing with people crying out for help, celebrating victory that God has given to them, talking about the greatness and majesty of God. And then right in the middle of this, you have a psalm dealing with a marriage. The marriage between a king and what is likely the daughter of a queen from a foreign country. He's going to later make reference to forget your father's house and your people. It was fairly common in the ancient world, in Israel and in other places, for a king to make a treaty with a foreign country by marrying one of the daughters of this country he was making a peace treaty with. The idea being that they are now family and so would probably be less likely to attack each other. Don't know for sure that that's the setting of this psalm, but based on some of the wording in the psalm and what we know about the ancient world, I think it's at least possible and it's consistent with what we find in the text. And so what's of interest also here is you get just a hint of a glimpse into the heart of the poet. In other words, as he begins the song, he said, "My heart overflows with a good theme." And I know from some friends of mine who are songwriters, and they talk about the fact that, you know, when a song comes to you, an idea, a thought, a melody, or whatever, you need to, as soon as you can, make sure you put that down or you record that so you don't lose it. That sometimes experiences of life, and we don't really always know what brings it on, but a poem or a song will come to one's thoughts and mind and heart, and it just begs to pour out. One of the things that's also of interest is he says, overflows with a good theme, and he goes on to talk about, my tongue is a pen for a ready writer. For us, a person who's writing a book might do it differently than a person, say, who's writing a song. Okay? A person who's writing a book might be tempted to think it and then write it. A person who's writing a song, if you're sitting down with your guitar, and people do it in different ways, but if you're sitting down with your guitar, often what would happen is the first thing you'll do is you'll think it, and then you'll sing it. And then later, once you're happy with what you've sung and the melody that goes with it, then you begin to write it down, and as you write it down, you begin to tinker with the words. My point is that for ancient poets and in the ancient world, poems and songs were often oral first. They were often spoken first and sung first and then written down so that posterity might keep the song. It's not always the way how all writing works down through time are today. What he does throughout this particular psalm is he, first of all, in the first portion, he talks about the groom. He talks about the king. Then in the second portion, he's going to talk about the bride or the queen. And in each section, he basically, as it seems to me, does two things. He's going to give a little bit of guidance to each one of them, and he kind of does this almost guardedly because he's giving guidance to a king and a queen, but he's reminding them of what they're to be all about and what they're to be doing in marriage and in their positions as king and queen. And then he's going to describe their glory and their goodness, their attributes, and especially he's going to describe what they look like in the wedding ceremony. So imagine a person, you know, sitting in the balcony back here as a wedding is taking place, and they're writing down what they're seeing, or they're trying to describe to maybe somebody sitting next to them, maybe a blind person is sitting next to them, and they're saying, "Hey, let me describe to you what it looks like. She's wearing this, and he's wearing that, and this person is there, and that person there, and here's how they're arranged on the stage." That's kind of what the poet does as he writes the psalm. He not only gives some guidance and describes the attributes of these people personally, but he describes the ceremony and describes what they're wearing and what is happening as the ceremony progresses. And so you have that concept of guidance and glory intermingled in each of those sections. So let's notice some things, first of all, that he says to and about the king. First of all, as you think about some things what I want us to gather from this, kind of the take-home stuff, is not so much the elaborate ceremony, it's not so much the garb they were wearing, but I want us to notice how he describes, not only how he guides them in what they should be doing, but how he describes what they're doing. For example, look in verse 2 as he's talking about the king. It says, "You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever." You got a therefore in verse 2 and another therefore in verse 7 that, in my opinion, are very important because they each describe something God is doing. But in each case, it is precipitated by something the king is doing. The idea is that God blesses the one who walks in His ways. And so he says, "Grace is poured upon your lips." Some translations will say, "poured through your lips." But the idea is that the king speaks with graciousness and kindness. He is the ruler of the land. He has in his hands the power of life and death. He has the power to command armies. But he says of this king, "You speak with grace and kindness." You remember as Jesus was talking to the apostles in the New Testament, he talked about the fact that the Gentiles lorded over the people. In other words, they used their power to crush people and to lift up themselves. Well, the picture given immediately here is of a king who doesn't use his power to hurt the people, but to graciously care for the people. He speaks with grace and kindness and goodness. And so the Lord blesses him. If you look in verses 3 down through verse 5, I want you to notice a couple of things here. First of all, in verse 3, he's giving some guidance to the king, and he says, "Gird your sword on your thigh, Almighty One." In other words, part of the role of the king in the ancient world was to function as a warrior, that he would send out his armies and on many occasions would actually lead his army into battle, would go with his army into battle. For example, that's how Josiah ended up dying, because he tried to intercede and stop Pharaoh Necho as he was trying to attack Assyria and attack a region that was in alliance with Josiah. And so the point is that the king often led the people literally into battle. And so he says to the king, "Your responsibility is to be willing to lead the people into battle, but you're not going into battle to get territory, to get power, to promote yourself, to conquer and have dominion over others. It's not all about power and it's not about self." Notice what he says. He says in verse 4, "And in your majesty ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness." He's not supposed to ride forth in battle with arrogance and pride about himself, but in meekness to pursue truth and righteousness. He fights to defend God's people. He fights to stop the enemies of the Lord. It's all about God and it's all about God's people. And what is right and true, it is not about the king and his personal glory and his personal power. If you look at verses 6 through 9, look in verse 6. You have an interesting statement right in the middle of this that folks struggle with, and I don't know that I have a nice pat answer for it. I'll give you some thoughts and suggestions. But right in the middle of this, where he is talking to the king, and it's clear that he is going to, in just a few moments, he's going to differentiate between the king and God, because look at the end of verse 7, "Therefore God, your God, has anointed you." So he's clearly differentiating that the king and God are two different people. But right in the middle, they're two different beings. And right in the middle of this, in verse 6, he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever." Suddenly, right in the middle of this, he either talks to God or he speaks to the king as if he's God. And you'll find folks that look at this, take it in different directions. But you can't deny that he stops and addresses someone as God. Now again, he's going to clearly say the king is not God the Father. And so I think either he is stopping for a moment and speaking to the Father and honoring and recognizing the fact that it is God who is truly king and truly reigns on his throne, or what he is doing is saying that you represent God as his king on his throne. In other words, because God is the one who puts him on the throne. He's going on to say, in last of verse 6, "A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness." In other words, the purpose of your kingship is to promote righteousness and goodness and truth, and it is to fight evil and wickedness. Because of that, God has established your throne. It is the power of God that gives you the authority to rule. If you look in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and following, it basically says all authority, all governmental authority is delegated or passed down from God. If God doesn't allow it, it cannot exist. But it says specifically that God does not just allow him to rule, but God places him on the throne and empowers his throne, especially so long as it is a leadership of righteousness and goodness and truth. And so it may be that he is saying, "Your throne, O God, is established forever," because he's speaking about the fact that the person on the throne is God's man doing God's will, ruling by his authority and his power. But what is important to me is, again, what kind of king he was to be. Not only one who speaks grace, but one who promotes and fights for righteousness and goodness. And then in verses 8 and 9, you have a description of the glory of his apparel. It talks about him being anointed with the oil of joy. This could be referring to the anointing of him as king. It also can be referring to an anointing that was a part of the marriage ceremony. His garments had fragrances on them that were from around the world. At least two of the fragrances are thought to be from India. One is thought to be from Arabia. He talks about out of ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad. The words stringed instruments are actually not in the text, but most translators believe in the context that that's probably what is happening here. So you have the picture of him coming out of an ornate room or building where you've got ivory furniture. Sometimes they even put ivory on the walls. You've got the wedding music playing as he departs. You've got his entourage. It says your king's daughters are among your noble ladies. You've got royalty in the entourage. And it says at your right hand stands the queen in the gold from Ophir. And it's not known for sure exactly where Ophir is. We know in the reign of Solomon that he received a great deal of gold from this region. Some believe that it's in the region of what is now Saudi Arabia. But he's just describing the splendor of this wedding. He is in his royal garb and his queen's at his right hand and she's decked out in gold jewelry and fine clothing. And then he kind of stops for a moment and he steps back and he moves away from them standing together and goes back to the chamber where the bride is getting dressed. And he starts talking to her. And notice if you start in verse 10, he says, "Listen, O daughter, give attention, incline your ear." And he says, "Forget your people and your father's house." Remember, this may well be a lady who is from a foreign land. And he says, "I know it's hard." In other words, "I know it's difficult, but it's time for you to put aside the past. Your allegiance now is to the king, and your allegiance now is to your spouse." He says, "The king then will desire your beauty. Because he is your lord, bow down to him." And again, you need to remember that in the reference to bow down, that this is not just her husband. This is the king of the land. She is marrying a king of a foreign country. And so she is not only to respect him as a husband, but she is to honor him as the king of all the land. And so the idea is giving her devotion to the king, being devoted completely to him, and being submissive to his leadership. And says if she'll do this, it says the daughter of Tyre will come with a gift. It's interesting that the region of Tyre was the first region, the first foreign power to recognize the rulership of David's family. And that David and Solomon had a special trade relationship with the region of Tyre. And then he goes on in verse 13 and through 15 to describe the beauty as she is coming out of her inner chamber. It says the king's daughter is all glorious within. Now that may be talking about an inner beauty, which is a powerful thought as you think about, for example, 1 Peter chapter 3, where it says, "Let not women be adorned with outer apparel, but with an inner beauty of the heart." That would be a great parallel. And maybe that's what he's saying. The problem is that's not how the word's normally used. It's normally used to describe being inside a structure, inside a building. And so most believe that the idea is that here she's in her inner chamber with her bridesmaids, and then you're going to have this procession as they are moving then to the palace. So you've got back in verse 9, the king and queen standing beside each other. Then the poet is going to take them, kind of stop time, okay, and let's talk about how she got there. He's going to take you back to the changing room and then take you from there back to the moment where she's standing by the king again. Her clothing is interwoven with gold in verse 13. She's led to the king in embroidered work. And so you just have this description of the bride and her entourage making their way to the king. Then in verses 16 and 17, you have the conclusion of the song. And it's basically a pronouncement of blessing. That as your fathers went before you, so your sons shall carry on your heritage after you. Your name will be remembered from generation to generation. And the idea is that not only will your name be remembered in this psalm, but the name of the king will be carried on in the king's children. The king's children, his sons, shall be princes in the land. And that what was very important to a king in the ancient world was his lineage, his heritage, the generations that carried on his name and his kingdom and what he stood for. And he says, because in essence you are a king living and leading in righteousness, this is what is going to be the destiny and the future of your kingship and your kingdom. So that's just a highlight of what he's doing as he's giving this description of the wedding psalm. What I want us to think about for just a moment is how this then can be applied to us. We've talked about the king, now let's talk about the Christian. As we talk about the Christian, I want us to talk first of all for just a moment about the husbands and then about the wives. As we think about the husbands here, I want us to kind of draw some parallels between those of us who are husbands and the king in this particular wedding song. As I think about what the king did, I think of consecration, I think of direction, and I think of protection. The king is praised in this psalm because he's consecrated. All that means is dedicated to the Lord. He's consecrated to the Lord. In other words, grace can be found on his lips. He speaks with grace and kindness. He lives for righteousness and truth. He's embodied by meekness. In other words, he seeks to live a godly life. And consistent with that consecrated, holy, godly life, he seeks to lead the nation in that same direction. He goes into battle for the benefit of the nation that righteousness and truth and graciousness might prevail. That's what his leadership as king is all about. He also seeks to protect God's people. He goes to battle not for his own benefit, but for the benefit of God's. I want us to think about ourselves as dads and as husbands. Are we consecrated to God? If someone wrote a psalm about our life, would they say that we're living a life of consecration? That we're living a life of direction in which we're trying to lead our families to God? I'm reminded of Ephesians chapter 6, in which it says, fathers are to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. We may not lead a nation as did the king in Psalm 45, but we have a responsibility to be godly men, graciousness and kindness and goodness should be on our lips. We should not lead our family with heavy-handed tactics, with control and fear and domination, but with grace and kindness and meekness. The focus of what we do as a family should not be on just putting money in the bank, but it should be upon promoting righteousness and goodness. And we should be willing to do all, be willing to go to battle and even die, to protect not only righteousness and goodness, but to protect our families, to be willing to do whatever it takes to take care of God's people, because that family, they're God's people, and they've been entrusted to us. As he talks to the wives, I think he alludes especially to devotion and submission. As I think about what he said here, as he talked about to that queen, he says, "Forget your people and your father's house." I can't help but think of Genesis 2 and Matthew 19, where he talks about when a man and a wife come together, they become one flesh. And it says they're to leave and cleave. Remember? They're to leave father and mother and cleave to one another. That word cleave literally means to be glued together. And so many times I find that marriages struggle because the cleaving doesn't happen, because the leaving doesn't happen. The glue is not strong. The glue is not binding. The glue is not permanent in the marriage because one or both parties never let go of the past. They never let go of their families. They never let go of their allegiances to their mothers or to their fathers. And so instead of putting their attention on and their devotion to their spouse, they're putting it as equal or maybe even more devotion to their families. And that's inconsistent with everything we see in Scripture. But also the idea of submission. That doesn't mean that the wife has to bow down like he did in our psalm, because you need to remember that he's not only a husband in that psalm, he's a king. And so you're not married to a king, though maybe sometimes he acts like he's one. But there still needs to be that respect. And that's what's talked about in Ephesians chapter 5. In fact, Ephesians 5, 22 and following, it talks about that relationship between husband and wife. And it says the husband is to love and cherish his wife. Now that's that king that loves his nation and is willing to go battle for that nation and die for that nation. And with that, there comes a wife who respects the leadership of her husband. And the more he loves her and the more he's willing to go to battle for her, the stronger will be her respect and her devotion. And finally, there's generation. That we need to think about as he talked about the king and queen and the heritage that would be carried on in future generations. I think as husbands and wives, we need to think about what kind of heritage are we leaving. If we have children, what kind of children are we leaving behind? Will they carry on a heritage of graciousness and righteousness and meekness and truth? What are we leaving in their hearts and minds based on how we take care of each other and love each other? It is my prayer as we think about a king and a queen and their relationship that we'll think about the relationships in our homes, and that if we'll treat each other like kings and queens and quit taking each other for granted, then we will leave a heritage of faith. You know, we go to the beach, we like looking for seashells and so forth. One of the things we'd never successfully gotten home was a sand dollar. So we went to the beach, we'd found one the last time we went to the beach, but it was broken before we could get it back to the room and much less start the trip home. But this time we went to the beach, we started looking and the weather had changed things. And before the week was over, you know, we just scrutinized the beach. We'd go every night and early every morning trying to find sand dollars. But by the end of the week, this week was unlike any week we'd ever known before. We found 27. Now that first one, you're like, oh, we finally found one. We've been looking for years. Let's get this one back. Okay, you guard it and you're protected. In fact, we even found another one and it broke on the way back. But what happens by the time you get to 27? Oh, if this one breaks, I've got another one. In fact, we've got 26 more or whatever the case may be. When we got married, we carried that marriage like it was precious. Just don't do anything to hurt it. Don't do anything to destroy it. This is till death does us part. But as the years pass and problems pile up and things change, what happens? It becomes routine. And we say, oh, if this doesn't work, I'll just go get another one. Maybe if we could keep the emotion and power of the wedding song for our whole lives, then maybe more marriages would last. The final thing of consequence here is that ultimately the Hebrew writer is going to take a portion of Psalm 45 and he's going to apply it to Jesus. And he's going to say of Jesus, the scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of righteousness. Therefore, God has established you on the throne forever. Your throne, O God, is forever. And as we think about that, I want us to think about three quick things. First of all, the true and eternal King who deserves all our allegiance is not a king of Israel or a king of America or any other nation down through history. But it's Jesus Christ, whom the Revelator describes in chapter 19 as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Not only is He the eternal King, but He is the example of how to live as husband and wife. If you want to know, you say, Preacher, can you give me a really good book on how to be a good husband or a good wife? Then just read the Gospels and look at how Jesus treated people. And read Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22 and following. The message is, Jesus teaches us how to love and how to lead. But finally, the expression of Jesus' love can be seen in His church. In Ephesians 5, the church is described as the bride of Christ, and that He has expressed His love for the bride by being willing to go to battle for us, just like the king in Psalm 45. He fought for us and died for us on the cross of Calvary. Now, as we think about ourselves as His bride, the question is not, does He express our love to us, His love to us? The question is, do we express our love to Him? Are we faithful? Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? One of the things we noticed at the beach is Saturday morning before we came back home, there was a wedding down on the beach. And so I took a picture. They were having a wedding ceremony right at the end of the pier when you walk down to the beach. As you think about, you know, there have been all kinds of places they've had weddings and all, you know, weddings come in all kinds of shapes and forms and fashions. They've been in castles and remote islands. I read about one couple that got married at a 7-Eleven because that's where they met. I mean, just all kinds of places. But the most beautiful wedding ceremony, one of the most beautiful wedding ceremonies ever, is found at our baptism. Because the New Testament describes the church as the bride of Christ. Galatians chapter 3, verse 26 and 27 says that through faith we become sons of God. For as many, in verse 27 it says, for as many as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. The picture is of putting on a garment like a bride or a groom put on their wedding clothes. That at our baptism we marry Christ. We commit to Christ for life. If you've never done that, then we would like to be a part of your wedding today. We would like to be a part of your giving your life to Christ by expressing your faith in repentance, confession, and baptism. For those of us who are already committed to Christ, I want us to ask ourselves, are we faithful, faithful followers? And if we need to make some changes, whether it's private changes and prayers in our closet or changes in our homes, or if it's something public that needs to be confessed and prayed for this audience, do whatever it takes. Follow the example of the King as we stand and sing.